Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Phil Craig.
And I'm Andrew Loney.
And together we aim to bring you the most scandalous stories and some of the most scandalous people in history. So thanks for joining us here on the Scandalmongers podcast.
So we've been travelling.
I've flown in from Palm Beach this morning just to do this podcast. And then I'm off to Sri Lanka tomorrow to talk about Mountbatten's. But today we're talking about something that someone's asked us to look at, and that's whether George VI had a mistress or two, which everyone finds very hard to believe. But we are going to talk to someone later who may shed some light on that. And I think you would like me to. I did a bit of research, and I think I've got a few little leads myself on George VI.
Goodness me.
Well, they all had affairs, so it's nothing new.
Yeah, welcome, everybody, to our most outrageously, scandalously gossipy episode yet. Expect innuendos, half-truths, and unprovable allegations. Such fun.
Yes, yes. Well, we're going where no other royal biographer has gone before. Someone today was telling me that they thought that Anthony Blunt was George V's illegitimate son. I don't think there's any truth in that. And someone was, in fact, trying to get me to research that the Queen Mum gave birth to Princess Margaret, but had an affair with Victor Sassoon, who was a Jewish businessman, and that was her real father. So I'm afraid that one hasn't got any legs either.
Yeah, the whole thing with, you know, who was Harry's father? Was it James Hewitt? This is as old as royalty itself. Always been these kind of scandals. And we could discuss later whether it matters, why we're interested, whether we should be interested. But the truth is, we are interested. And Tom actually is such a great guest to take us into this area, because his whole life and his family's life for many generations are really kind of the sort of professional royal hangers-on, I suppose you could say.
He's continuing to the present day and as a journalist rather than a courtier.
Yes.
But yeah, I've been struck with in all my research that, you know, certain families like the Mountbattens and others, you know, go back three or four generations, very, very closely linked to the royals. I mean, clearly related to the royals too. But, you know, you see these private secretaries like Michael Adeen, you know, who follow in a family tradition with fellows. Fergie's father worked for Prince Charles. I mean, they keep people very close to them.
Well, this is the secret, isn't it? I mean, if you're going to have a life where who you marry and the children you bear, kind of it's your job, it's your dynastic job. So often these will be negotiated relationships. And then the romantic, the passionate, the fun relationships are something that happens in parallel. And you keep it all within a very tight circle. Maybe people gossip about it, but actually nobody knows really anything for sure. Nobody really cares. Life goes on. And Tom's family, as I'm sure he'll talk about, has sort of been part of that over several generations, this sort of the naughty secret side of royal life. But it's more than just Tom, isn't it? I mean, you and all the work you've done, Andrew, on the Windsors, you've come across some kind of harder evidence, I think, that perhaps George VI was just like all the rest of them and got away with it.
Well, I mean, I've certainly, you know, Lady Colin Campbell, I suppose, has gone furthest in terms of the biographies talking about the mistresses. There have been other people who have alluded to it. And clearly I found mistresses when I did both the Duke of Windsor and I did the Mountbattens, and indeed illegitimate children. I talked in Thread of King about a man called Seeley, who I think, who's still alive, who I'm pretty sure is the son of the Duke of Windsor. And there are a number of other people I mentioned in the book, which, you know, there is some quite strong evidence to suggest they possibly were. But George VI is interesting. I mean, there are four names that are generally mentioned. One is Camilla Sykes, that Tom's going to talk about, his grandmother. Another is Phyllis Monkman. Another is Evelyn Boulé, Maureen Stanley, and then Peter Townsend's wife, Rosemary Townsend, and then someone called Magdalen Eldon.
So Peter Townsend, who went out with
Princess Margaret. And, you know, if we remember, he was the innocent party in that divorce. She had an affair with a man called de Laszlo. And it's suggesting that actually Rosemary Townsend may have had an affair after that with George VI. Now, this is what Lady Colin Campbell says.
And all these women, they're very much kind of in the tent, aren't they? They're real insiders.
They fall into two categories, either the aristocrats or the actresses. And I mean, that's always one of the great concerns, to get involved with an actress. I mean, it was always said of Philip, his affairs were with actresses or aristocrats. And certainly with George VI, I mean, before he got married to the Queen Mum, Queen Elizabeth, he seems to be involved with a series of actresses. He was a bit of a late developer compared to his older brother. And one woman that's mentioned is a musical comedy star called Marjorie Gordon. There's a Gaiety girl called Ruby Miller. Phyllis Monkman was a sort of star of the London theatrical world in the 1920s. She was 3 years older than Bertie. And according to the diaries of Cecil Beaton, he lost his virginity to her in 1919. I mean, she was almost asked to step forward and do her duty. And she was an interesting figure. She was a sort of great friend of Ivan Novello and Noel Coward. I mean, I saw this even with Mountbatten. Mountbatten got one of his mistresses to sleep with his grandson to initiate him into sex. So it is an extraordinary sort of world. But what was interesting about Phyllis Monkman is that according to a letter from the future Edward VIII to his mistress, Frieda Dudley Ward, George actually lost his virginity just before the end of the First World War in October 1918, when the letter talks about the deed was done, though no further details were shared. But it was said that Albert remained close to Monkman, sending her a birthday present every year until her death, aged 84, and that on her death, a wallet was found with a picture of him inside. And the other woman that's often connected with him is an Australian called Sheila Chisholm. She was the same age as him. She was married to the rather raffish Lord Loughborough, heir to the Earl of Roslin. And she was a close friend of Edward's mistress, Frieda Dudley Ward. So the four of them used to go out as the four Jews. Now, there's some dispute about whether there was an affair with Sheila Chisholm. There were also rumours that her sister had a child, a royal child, but I think there's no truth in that. But George V was so appalled by his son carrying on with this married woman with two children that he said that he wouldn't make him his son Duke of York if he continued seeing her. And Bertie wrote to his elder brother that she was the one and only person in this world who means anything to me, but he bowed to his father's wishes. And the biographer of Sheila Chisholm, Michael Robert Wainwright, discovered that after World War II, Chisholm was taken to dine at Buckingham Palace by a diplomat called Sir Charles Hebben Johnson, who wrote in his diary how Bertie and Sheila had got to reminiscing. Sheila, seeing the Queen listening intently, added, "And when you think, sir, how innocent it all was." George, red with fury, replied, "Innocent? I don't know what the devil you mean, he said.
So it is a side of royal and aristocratic life that does continue to fascinate. I was thinking about, was it George Bernard Shaw was writing about the boring middle class morality of his time? And so this is why the royals remain popular, because they enjoy the things that the great mass of the working class also enjoy. It's yes, a rather rude way of putting it, but he probably meant, I think he listed them as alcohol, fornication, horse racing, and boxing.
Well, maybe boxing has dropped off the list in the same way.
But there is something in that, I think, you know.
Yes, no, there is. I mean, I think there is a bond there. Well, this is the character Evelyn Leigh. She only died. She was born in 1900. She died in 1996. And George met her in 1920 at a performance of the musical comedy The Shop Girl. And he was rather taken with her. And in the words of the Dowager Lady Harding of Penshurst, the widow of his principal private secretary, and an intimate and lifelong friend of the Queen Mother, the King was rather more than a little in love with Evelyn Leigh. And Lady Colonel Campbell says that the same opinion was confided to me by the Queen Mother's late private secretary, Sir Martin Gilliatt, who knew Leigh socially. And this is Lady Colin writing, "Of course, Her Majesty the Queen Mother has always been aware of the King's intense admiration for Boo, he told me. She found it rather touching and trusted absolutely in Boo's discretion. Leigh's caution with regard to any discussion of the matter was maintained until her death in 1996. She forbade any mention of it in her ghost-written autobiography, Boo to My Friends, published in 1958, which contains only one reference to the King. And when I showed her the proposed text of an article I wrote about her in the 1970s, which described the King's fervent admiration of her, she struck out the passage, writing in the margin, 'Not in the Queen Mother's lifetime.'" In fact, this comes from Michael Thornton, who's another royal biographer. And so, yet despite his undoubted devotion to his wife, and it was said that the Queen Mum didn't like sex, whom he once described to their older daughter, the present Queen, as the most marvellous person in the world in my eyes, there remains a startling possibility that George VI continued to carry a flame for one of Britain's most dazzling stars.
Well, we should have Lady Colin on again.
Yes, no.
But what do you really think, Andrew? I mean, George VI, of all of them, I suppose, had the reputation, perhaps until this podcast, as being kind of a bit boring, a little bit, you know, didn't have the sort of, obviously nothing like Edward or his own father. Almost he was not, never intended to be king when he was born. And maybe, I always assume he has a fairly quiet sort of a life. But all this is a very different, you know, he feels like a raffish man about town with lots of affairs going on. Do you buy that image of him?
Well, I think we haven't really got the true picture of George VI. There's just been a biography by Sally Bedell Smith, which I've been reading, but that very much is a conventional picture. And time again, you know, we have a succession of books about members of the royal family, which more or less all say the same thing and present them as these paragons of virtue. And then someone comes along and writes something, you know, with evidence to back it that shows that isn't the case. So I think there's probably more to this than meets the eye. I mean, it'll be interesting to hear what Tom says about the relationship with his grandmother. I mean, Lady Colin Campbell is well connected. And I mean, she certainly talks in her book. She says, "Now the war was over, he turned his attention to three safely married women." I mean, that was always the key, that they'd delivered, as you say, the heirs themselves, and they could then have fun. And she says, "For her part, Elizabeth proved herself to be as indulgent of Bertie's involvement with Rosemary Townsend, Magdalen Eldon, and Camilla Sykes as she had been with Boulay and Maureen Stanley. Each of these women had an interesting background. Each was stunningly good-looking." And then she talks about the various characters and their background. And she says that by 1946, Bertie was flirting openly with Rosemary, while Princess Margaret was making a more covert play for Peter. The sight of father and daughter behaving so...
Is it like a soap opera?
The royal family is a soap opera.
Cheating across the generations. It's like...
Well, you know, I found even
the Beverly Hillbillies or something.
Matt Batten was passing on his mistresses to Prince Philip. I mean, they sort of, you know, they sort of... It's like a sort of pet. They pass them on.
We're turning into an advert for the Republican movement, I think.
The sight of father and daughter behaving so flirtatiously with husband and wife under the benign and approving gaze of Queen Elizabeth was too much for people such as my father-in-law, Ian Campbell, 11th Duke of Argyll, who felt the hypocrisy was unendurable. And then she goes on, indeed, once Bertie was dead and Princess Margaret's romance with Group Captain Peter Townsend became public knowledge, Elizabeth would find her complacent smile wiped right off her face. She talks about how Rosemary and Peter Townsend were divorced in 1952. She married John de Laszlo, the son of the famous society portrait painter. They divorced in 1977. And she then talks about how she got to know Rosemary Townsend, who told her these things.
Okay, well, I mean, this is lifestyle of the rich and famous, isn't it? This is some...
Why must people
jumping in and out of bed with each other? I think we should go to Tom because...
I think he get it from the horse's mouth.
If you keep reading from her book, she's going to sue us for copyright breach.
That's true. Well, I'm just the warm-up act for
her. No, well, I think Tom's got a lot to say about this and other things. So let's go to him.
No, let's do that.
More gossip incoming.
Hi, guys. Thanks very much for having me on here today. So I'm the royal journalist for the Daily Beast. I'm the royal correspondent for the Daily Beast, which is in America, it's a very well-known online publication, and we cover a whole range of things. And I was actually hired for the Daily Beast by the great Tina Brown, the founding editor, who, of course, be well known to royal fans.
She was on our show last week.
Oh, right. Okay.
She was the warm-up act for you. She was...
no comment. Well, Tina was great. But I suppose my interest in the royal family really dates back to some kind of stories that went around in my family. An uncle of mine in the 1880s called Christopher Sykes, I've got the details here, so just forgive me, because my other cousin Christopher Simon Sykes wrote this very good book about the Sykes family, which has got some of the details in it.
We'll put that on the website.
Yeah, no, and it is a good book. It is a good book. So Christopher Sykes was born in 1831 and he died in 1898. And he was a conservative politician. He sat in the House of Commons his signature piece of legislation in the House of Commons was a law that was passed protecting seabirds. And he was ridiculed in Vanity Fair as the gull's friend because of this, because his one piece of legislation that he got passed in 1869. But he became a close friend of Edward VII, who was then obviously the Prince of Wales, and was, of course, quite a famous hedonist, shall we say, Edward VII, and was, of course, famously the longest serving Prince of Wales, waiting for his dear mother, Queen Victoria, to die. And Christopher became a very good friend of the Prince of Wales. I'm not sure exactly how he got to know him in the first place, but, you know, they were from a kind of, you know, rich family in Yorkshire. His brother was a baronet. Like, they used to hang out in London at the Marlborough Club. They were known as the Marlborough Set by some, and the Marlborough House Set. And the relationship kind of deteriorated, and because Christopher was overly sort of impressed and overly sycophantic, really, to the Prince of Wales. And what happened was that as they would drink in the evenings and get drunk and have fun. The king developed a habit of pouring his glass of brandy over poor old Psyche's head. And the brandy would then drip off his nose. And Christopher would reply, "As your royal highness pleases." And this became a kind of party act that that Edward would dump a glass of brandy over poor old Christopher's head. And this was really only the most graphic illustration of what was going on, because behind the scenes, Christopher was running up huge debts to entertain and to stay part of this kind of very exclusive club. And ultimately, it would have ruined him and led to him going bankrupt. He was actually bailed out at the last minute. And my grandfather, who was called Christopher Sykes as well, wrote the most brilliant series of essays. There were four essays called Four Studies in Loyalty. So my grandfather was, he was a writer, and he was like Evelyn Waugh's best friend. And he wrote Evelyn Waugh's biography, which for many years was the kind of standard work on Evelyn Waugh. It was subsequently kind of displaced by, I think, Selina Hastings did a yep. brilliant kind of biography. But Christopher, one of the first books he wrote was called Four Studies in Loyalty. And it's absolutely, there are four different stories in it. And one of them is the story of Psyche and the Prince of Wales. And really, that's where a lot of the information comes from. But I say that really by way of a preface to the other story that has done the rounds in the family over the years, which is that there was a rumour that my grandmother, who was called Camilla Russell, had what is often termed a romantic friendship with King George VI. Better known to most of us these days as Bertie, the stammering king from the King's Speech. and they were friends, really. So Christopher, so we're on a generation now, and my grandfather, Christopher Sykes, who died when I was kind of 12, I suppose, so kind of, 40 years ago, and the writer and his wife Camilla Russell, and they were friends really of the royals, of the king and the queen, of George VI and the lady who of course we know better as the Queen Mother, but who they rather rudely referred to as Bulging Bess.
I've not heard Bulging Bess. Gosh, so when was this friendship? When did it start?
So. It's hard to know exactly, but I did actually, my father actually died 18 months ago. And I did, before he died, I did get him to write some of it down, so I have got some of it here. But as far as I can tell, it was definitely, I think that it sort of began perhaps towards the end of the war, so in the kind of 1940s. And I think my grandfather was away at the war. He was in the Special Forces, and he was behind the lines in eastern France near Metz for 2 years, living in the woods, setting up an advance camp for the Americans to come through. And this is another story in the collection for Studies in Loyalty. And I think that it possibly began then, because then in 1945, they bought the lease on a very lovely double-fronted house on Eton Terrace, Christopher and Camilla. Now, I hasten to add that buying a lease on a house in Eaton Terrace in 1945 was probably the best year ever that you could have bought a lease, because the whole of London was completely destroyed and bombed and no one had any money. but they, presumably through a sort of, I suppose Christopher would have had a trust fund from the Sykeses and Camilla probably had a trust fund from the Russells. They bought this lovely house on Eaton Terrace. It's not, I've been to look at it. It's not incredibly grand. It's not one of those big pillar jobs, you know, on Eaton Square, but it's a beautiful house. And as far as I can tell, part of the reason they bought that was to entertain their set, which included the King and Queen. And so the King and Queen would come for dinner a couple of times a year. And because of rationing, the only way that you could really provide a dinner or something like that sort of legally was to get a hotel to do it and to deliver the food to the house, which is what they used to do. So my father, who was born in 1937, remembered, you know, looking over the balcony and seeing the King and Queen arrive, seeing, Len, the odd job man, dressed up as a butler for the evening, them going into the side room and having their cocktails and their drinks and all that kind of thing. And there was always this rumour that Camilla and the King enjoyed a bit more of a friendship, perhaps.
Are the letters?
One thing that they, unfortunately, I have to tell you right now, I've looked many years and there's absolutely no documentary evidence of this. There are no letters.
This rumour in your family, Tom. Clearly, your father would have heard it, given that his parents were friendly, perhaps very friendly, with the royal family. Was it sort of openly spoken of, or just some slightly whispered, slightly embarrassing, naughty secret?
I mean, did you ever talk to Camilla about it?
No, Camilla died when I was really quite young. She died quite young, so I would have only been 7 or 8 when Camilla died. You're right. I don't think it was, as far as I know. I mean, I've talked to other members of my family about it, and they've said, oh, you know, yeah, it was definitely, we heard that. But they would, you know, they would hang out a lot. One of the things they liked to do, the King and Camilla, was they liked to go to Victoria Palace and enjoy sort of variety shows in the music halls. In the music hall at Variety Palace, and then they would go back to the palace and have a private dinner in a little octagonal dining room on the first floor. There's a couple of funny anecdotal stories. So one of the things that I actually do remember is my grandfather doing an impression of the King seducing his wife, which began, "Come and see here, my little flower, and sit upon my knee."
Difficult to imagine George VI doing that.
Amongst the sort of circles, people who live in grand houses near Eaton Square, and people who are around the royal family for many generations, and in the subsequent to this era, it's always been understood that there were these discreet liaisons, and often the husbands looked the other way, like good old Parker Bowles looked the other way for a long time. And that was just understood. Do you think your granddad was such a man, or was it something?
Oh, I think totally. I mean, I think they both had their own things going on. I think that my grandmother was apparently delighted when her firstborn was a son, because it meant she didn't have to have any more children, which would have ruined her figure. I think it was a different kind of time, you know, and I try to be very unjudgmental about it, because I think that what those people went through in the Second World War is just so unimaginable. I mean, imagine going and living in a forest in France for two or three years, not knowing if any day was going to be your last. Imagine half of your town being destroyed and bombs being rained on it. I mean, I think there's all this stuff about
your father. Tom,
I just want to say one thing, which I think there's all this nonsense about, you know, has Prince William had an affair? Has he not had an affair? You know, and of course, there's always been stories about it. Well, I would like to point out that if he hasn't had an affair, he will be the first Prince of Wales in history to have never had an affair. So, you know,
well, this is what
you'd be letting the side down if you didn't.
Diana and Charles used to argue about this, didn't they?
But you've picked up stories because, I mean, you're very well connected in those sort of circles. I mean, you've written about it when the press in Britain didn't write about it. But, I mean, you have in the Daily Beast about not just one affair with William, but several. Is that right?
Well, there's definitely always been rumours that, you know, William, you know, had, you know, had affairs. Those have always been rumours. In a way, it seems to me like those rumours will never be substantiated or they'll never be stood up, because it seems to me that the people who have been named by some publications as the person he's had an affair with are sort of drawn from that same aristocratic circle. Yeah.
Well, that's how it works, isn't it?
Well, and I think a little bit of the same thing. You know, obviously, if you're the king and you want to have an affair with somebody, you need to be reasonably careful who you decide to do that with. But so there were only really ever, and sadly, I'd love to have written a book about it, and I did try, and I did some research about it, but there's just no physical evidence. You know, there's no letters, anything like that was destroyed.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at Burrow.com/ACAST. That's Burrow.com/ACAST. Burrow.com/ACAST.
Another quite funny story.
Sorry to interrupt. Well, another quite strong evidence in the way your father looked. He looks just like George VI.
Well, no, I think it predates. I think the relationship predates the birth of my father. But another quite funny story that is in the winter of 1949. Christopher and Camilla were invited to a ball at Buckingham Palace, and so the whole of Britain was shivering with rationing and shortages and a three-year wait for a new car, clothing coupons. Well, Buckingham Palace threw this lavish party with champagne, dishes, pheasant, partridge, you know, because you're allowed game, obviously, was exempt from the rationing from Sandringham, hundreds of guests. And the rumour was that the king and Camilla did not join this big celebration, but had a quiet dinner à deux in a smaller little dining room. Said to be, my father always insisted it was an octagonal dining room. So I don't know, that perhaps is one thing I could investigate. But Christopher was chatting to the US ambassador to London, an acquaintance of his at the bar, and a friend of the ambassador's came over and greeted him. And Christopher, the ambassador, turned to his friend and said, this is Christopher. And then he said, Christopher, I'm so sorry, I must apologize. I've completely forgotten your last name. And Christopher is said to have replied, Colonel Keppel.
Oh, golly. And Keppel, of course, was another mistress of Edward VII.
But so it's Alice Keppel was the
king
well-known having
an
mistress.
Affair with Camilla. That's two of them.
Was there any suggestion that the Queen Mother had romantic friendships, or was she just looking the other way while her husband did?
God, I don't know. I genuinely don't know. Anyway, the last tiny anecdote I have to tell you about this is that my father had a dreadful stammer, which he inherited from his father, who also had a stammer, and my father was treated by Mr. Logue, the speech therapist from the King's Speech, because the King said to my mother, "Oh, you must take and see this wonderful man," you know, blah 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 blah.
That's interesting.
So I don't know. I mean, and the other funny thing is that when the King died in 1952, I mean, literally the moment that he died, they gave up the lease on the house in Eaton Terrace and moved to the country. And my father said to his mother, why are we leaving London? She said, well, there's no point being here anymore now that the King has died. And I think it was the end of an era when George VI died. I think, you know, Elizabeth was obviously, you know, such a brilliant monarch in so many, you know, she was the right woman at the right time for the job, but she definitely wasn't fun like the previous sort of generations. You know, there was no wildness.
Her sister was quite wild.
I mean, but as far as I know, that's when the association kind of ended. They were both invited to the funeral.
When we talk about these scandalous, gossipy things, which, let's face it, are fun, especially if it's in your own family. But the question is, does it matter? Should we care if the people at the top of our society are secretly having affairs? Why the hell not? I mean, or
everyone
should we know
is.
Because they represent something bigger than themselves, the nation or the church?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty amazing, isn't it? I think when DNA testing came in, I think it was a bit of a shocker for people to realise how many people discovered that, you know, they had secret brothers or secret sisters, or their fathers weren't their father, their mother, you know. So I think the royals have to, I don't know. I mean, I think what's so... you know, I love the story as well. And you must have had Georgie Campbell on. You should get, if you haven't, you should get her on.
Yes, we have.
People who talked about
Camilla Sykes being a lover.
Yes. Well, and she also presumably told you her amazing, it's not her theory, but the amazing theory that she did a lot to popularise about the Queen Mother being the cook's daughter. Did you tell you that?
That's been widely reported now.
Such an amazing, fantastic story. And, you know, at the same time, obviously very practical. I mean, if you've had 9 female children in a row or whatever it was they had, and you're going to lose the house, I mean, you're compelled, really, to, you know, try and save the place. So, I don't know. I mean, look, I sort of wonder...
I've got to say, we should explain to the listeners, this is a story that the Queen Mother basically used a surrogate, the cook, to have the child, to have the Queen. Isn't it? Yeah. Isn't that the story?
Yeah.
And that's why she was called
subsequently,
Cookie.
Yeah, better known
and,
as...
and the Queen's sort of second name was Marguerite, which is the name of the cook, which is not a royal name. I think the problem with that theory is that one of the interesting things is that the Queen Mum was seen at a dance shortly before she supposedly had the child, and no one felt that she was pregnant.
At the wrong end of the country, as well.
So we see certain parallels, because that's, of course, one of the accusations with Meghan, isn't it, that she's used a surrogate to have Archie. I mean, that brings us slightly
onto... I never really understood that one.
No, I didn't.
But that brings us slightly on to the, you know, you've got this very interesting foot in sort of both sides of the Atlantic. You're writing for an American audience. You're based in Britain. You clearly have very good connections in Britain, which is, I think, used to inform your journalism. I mean, do you find that that, I mean, that you find that there are two very different views of the royals on each side of the Atlantic, or is that, are they increasingly coming together into a common view?
I think it's really hard to tell. I think it's just, I think everything is so polarized now that I think that if you spend too much time trying to think about what people think, it's a really dangerous trap to go down. And I think as a writer or reporter or journalist, you just have to do the best with the sources that you have and the people who speak to you to tell the truth as you understand it. But I do think that I think there will always be a fascination with Harry and Meghan. And I think people will always, you know, I think they could at any point, I think they could click their fingers and get $1 million to go into an after dinner speech. I mean, I really do. So I think that the idea that they're sort of washed up can be a bit very much oversold, you know. I think perhaps what I do think is true is that I think in America people sort of they're a lot more, I don't know, they can sort of turn on you quite quickly in America, and it's not really turning on you, they just grow bored of you, and there's so many people competing for Americans' entertainment, for Americans' attention, that I think that I think they need to be careful, Harry and Meghan. And I think that, you know, I think they probably, I think they were very unlucky with their timing. Literally, COVID happened, you know, right after they left. And I think if COVID hadn't happened, they might have been able to give their independent careers a bit more of a kickstart. As it was, they were kind of becalmed for a couple of years. Then they did this interview with Oprah, which, you know, whilst it was big news at the time, I think ultimately, I think people wanted to hear it, and they wanted to hear it once. I don't think they needed to hear it all again in Harry's book. And I, you know, I think people don't, it's hard to listen to somebody just complaining the whole time, isn't it? I mean, we all have friends like that who just moan and moan and moan and moan about everything. And in the end, you're just like, do you know what? I actually don't want to spend, I don't want to spend any time with you.
So but what's the bigger problem for the monarchy, the Meghan or Andrew?
In a way, neither of them are a problem because they've managed to sort of cut themselves free of them. There is consternation, as I understand it, amongst some people of why have they made this very public show of support to Andrew and bringing Andrew back into the fold when it appeared they had quite successfully cut him off. And people can only really tell you that it's because Charles believes in unity, unguarded people might tell you off the record that they'd rather have the troublemakers inside the tent pissing out than outside the tent pissing in. And I think there's a bit of truth to that. But ultimately, I don't think Harry and Meghan are really a problem. I mean, I think, you know, they dropped the last truth bomb, right? Which was that it was Charles and Kate, the last truth bomb was accidentally dropped on their behalf, that it was Charles and Kate who were the royal racists. And what was the response? Charles, you know, Kate got a standing ovation at the Royal Albert Hall that evening. So I think they fluffed it. I think they took a shot. You know, it's an old saying, if you take a shot at the king, you better kill him. Well, they took a shot at the king and they really did not. It looked for a moment like it was really going to damage the royals. But actually, I'm kind of amazed that it didn't, that people really turned against Harry and Meghan.
And I think that, other shots in there that they can use? I mean, isn't that, are there rumours that she may do a book?
I think there are, but I mean, I don't know. I mean, I suppose she might have to if she needs the money, But I just wonder whether people in America are just going to go roll their eyes and go, we're tired of your bullshit. You know, I don't know. I just, that's slightly the feeling I get. I think it'd be a big risk to do another really negative tell-all book.
Gosh, and how about Fergie?
Especially if they
want this
career
from...
as TV producers and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Sorry,
what
was that, Andrew?
Distancing herself from Andrew? Because, I mean, her money is made in the States, and this can't be good for her brand.
I mean, that's what you would think, right? But she seems to take every opportunity she can to really associate herself with Andrew. So she's a clever, you know, I do think there is a really different level of respect and love for Fergie in America than there is in the UK. And I think we're warming to her a bit now in the UK. I think people are coming around to it and they're thinking, for God's sake, it was 20 years, 30 years ago, whatever, you know, and she's done her best and the world's changed and the world's moved on. And I think the late Queen was, you know, very important in helping that rehabilitation. But I don't know, like it's a funny one, isn't it? Because you would have thought that logically, yeah, she wouldn't want anything. I don't understand why anyone wants to. Why, who wants to walk to church, Prince Andrew, on Christmas morning? I don't get it. Don't get it. And there are, you know, there are people. I mean, someone was telling me this week that William's, you know, not particularly happy with the overall strategy, you know, but that, you know, he accepts the authority of his father and, you know, has to go along with it. And the last thing he's going to do is kick up another feud or another load of trouble. But I think really, if it, with hindsight, I think you'd have to say maybe it might have been better to leave Andrew in the shadows. I don't understand really what the advantage was in making him a... What do you think, Andrew? Because I know you're writing about Andrew. I mean, why...
I think it, you know, as you say, they want to have the person inside the tent rather than outside. I think it's about family unity. You know, they've got enough problems. Try and keep everyone on side if they can. I think, as you say, there's a sense of forgiveness. After all, the king had made a speech about the importance of family and forgiveness. He could hardly keep people out. But Andrew had been at Sandringham the previous year and just hadn't gone to church. So they could have easily done that. Mm. I don't think they realized what was in these depositions. I think they'd believed the things he had said. And now, of course, he's been caught out. There's far more there than I think he realized would come out. And so their strategy, they've been caught.
But actually, Andrew, do you know what? I disagree with you on that. There's nothing new. There's nothing new in those depositions. There's not one new thing in them. There's the thing that, because I actually did some research on this for a story I was doing this weekend, so I just double checked everything. The only thing that I thought might be new was this idea that Virginia Giuffre had been paid $15,000 by Andrew. That was out there 2020. Someone had written about that. The idea that he, you know, had participated in a teenage orgy or that he had sex with Virginia Giuffre, well, I mean, that's well out there. I mean, I agree, like, you know, at the same time, it's not a great week for Prince Andrew, but actually there's no new allegation in there. There is not one new allegation
there. He spent several weeks in Miami. I think the thing is we now have a much stronger sense of what was going on at the Epstein mansion, and he was spending a lot of time there. But I think the importance is we're getting legal depositions. You know, we've heard these stories, people have written or had interviews, but we've not had them give depositions under oath. And I think we've got several people talking. So I think the picture has come together. We were getting little fragments before, and suddenly we're seeing the full picture and on the basis of legal depositions. And certainly my research is pulling up quite a lot of other stuff. He's been caught lying repeatedly, covering his tracks, making trips there when he claimed to be doing other things. And so if he's lying about that, one wonders if he's lying about other things. And I think the worry must be that the people now these depositions have come out, that other people might come forward. I've certainly talking to a number of people who don't necessarily have had affairs with him or slept with him, but their friends did, and they're speaking on behalf of the friends. Now, of course, that's second-hand information, but there's no reason for these people to make it up. when someone's come to them and it's all sort of slightly off the record. So I don't know. I think
you're absolutely right that it pulls it all together. It pulls it all together and it puts it all in context. And it's like all these little bits of the mosaic have suddenly been put together in one sort of huge, you know, huge masterpiece.
Yeah, we had a sort of drip
stretched
drip
across the canvas,
and people sort of forgot.
Yeah.
You know, I've just even going through the cuts. I'm reminded of stories that I'd forgotten about, and I think suddenly we've got all this stuff together. But I think that's what happened. I don't think he'd been totally open with them, and now they've sort of had a panic about what's going to happen. But do you find there's a sort of tension? Yeah. Because I mean, you have very good contacts, and you protect your sources. I mean, do they speak to you because they sort of feel the story needs to get out? Or do they speak on behalf of other people that you feel sometimes you might be used? Why should people talk? Because as you say, there is this very strong omerta around the royal family.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's complicated. But I mean, ultimately, it comes down to trust, I suppose. But yeah, you're always aware that people are, you know, potentially trying to use you to get their narrative over. And it is, I suppose it's your job as a journalist to filter those out, you know, for your readers. And to you have to, ultimately, you have to make a decision about whether you trust your sources or not. I don't
but
know.
But why do they talk in really the first place? It. I mean, what's in it for them? Is it just friendship? Or getting the truth out?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm not really massively comfortable talking about the motivations of you know, people who speak to me in confidence, really.
Okay, no, fair enough. But I mean,
I want to go back to your own family, because all this is fascinating, talking about Andrew and Fergie and the rest of it. But
your father is even...
I'm disappointed. I was going to call you Sir or Your Majesty. I thought your dad definitely looked like a royal. But you're saying it's impossible. Is it the Harry and James Hewitt thing? The dates just don't match. Is that it?
Yeah. I mean, it's a bit of that. Yeah, it's a bit of that, Phil.
Oh, I don't know. I think you're covering up an even deeper, darker secret. That's what I think.
I mean, the thing is, it's such a... Well, he'd be unlikely to win Father of the Year. But he was good company, and a great raconteur, and that kind of thing. And I was just very lucky. So he actually, funnily enough, speaking about Georgie earlier, he actually sent Georgie three or four chapters, because he was very good friends. Georgie was really his best friend, and she was amazing to him.
You're talking about Lady Colin Campbell here. But people who don't know, Georgie,
Lady Colin Campbell.
Lady Colin Campbell, just, you know,
yes,
strange
yes.
British upper-class codes are being used. We should provide a glossary for our American and Australian.
Lady C was amazing. And just publicly, you know, say a big thank you to her, because she was fantastic to my father. And she really would have him down every weekend after my stepmother died. He spent every weekend there. And so he sent her... these chapters of the memoir, which she then sent to me after he died, which is how I know a lot of this stuff. So you know, it's great. I mean, I knew it on background, but there's another brilliant story which sadly he didn't write down, which was the story of when he was sick on the king's shoes, which was one of his favorite stories. I think they like had been invited to Sandringham shooting or something, or maybe the king had come to Sledmere to shoot. I don't know. Anyway, the kids were lined up to meet the king. He said, I'm really not feeling well. Don't be ridiculous. You have to come meet you have to come be presented to the king. I'm really not feeling too good. Don't be ridiculous. You know, blah, blah. Was marched out and promptly vomited on the king's shoes. And apparently the king was very charming and said, don't worry about it.
Gosh. And you don't feel any deep kind of DNA ancestral drives pulling you towards a man who might pour brandy on your head or anything like that?
No, I'm glad, sir, don't. No.
But tell us a little bit about your father.
It's a wonderful way to sort of see the royals and how they really live in private, and perhaps their secret sense of fun and naughtiness. That's why it's so interesting, I think, to get that angle.
And you get it only from diaries and things like Noel Coward and people like that who clearly were very close. Because, I mean, your father, I mean, he went to prison. I mean, he had lots of wives. He had lots of different careers. I mean, he was quite a character. Can you sort of give us a quick portrait of him?
He put the Times obituary up on the
website.
No, that was a work of art, that obituary, definitely. I think a lot of it is a legacy of the war. I really do. And I think that we do actually forget, if you were born in 1937, quite how miserable and terrifying your childhood was. I mean, even if you were, you know, a member of the so-called upper classes or whatever, you know, you were always hungry. There was never enough to eat, and you know, everybody was coming home, you know, if they were coming home at all, missing an arm, missing a leg, you know, all these kinds of things. And so I do think that after the war, you definitely see, you know, that there is this, obviously the eldest sons and what have you keep inheriting their estates, and you know, nothing changes behind the walls of those big estates. But I think you definitely see this other kind of almost subculture of the aristocracy, you know, which really, really epitomized by people like my father, who thought, you know, I'm gonna have a fun, and I'm gonna have a laugh, and and the other thing that's really weird when you read the newspapers from those days is that the only people that they wrote about were aristocrats. I mean, when you read the Daily Express gossip column from, you know, 1958, it's absolutely extraordinary. It's all these sort of minor aristocrats. So my dad became my dad was a leader of this thing called the Chelsea Set in the kind of late 50s, early 60s. And they were kind of, you know, bright, young, aristocratic things, you know, who messed around in London. There was a lot of kind of gambling clubs. I mean, the Aspinall sort of gambling fortune sort of sprung out of that same era. So it was a lot of illegal gambling clubs. And it was a wild time. I mean, you know, one of my one of my father's friends who I said I was interviewing, and I said I was going to write a book. He said, "Well, I really don't think you should write a book about it." And I said, "Really, why not?" He said, "Well, people might misunderstand. You know, it was a very different time." And I said, "Well, what do you mean it was different? I know it was a different time. What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you see, if I was going to meet a friend at the Drones Club, you see, say for example, you know, and I was late, I'd run out onto the road and a bus would be coming down, and I'd hop onto the bus and I'd say, 'Oh, driver, you seem to have a flat tire at the back.' And he'd go, 'Oh, thanks very much, Governor.' And he'd jump off the bus and he'd run around and have a look to have a look at the tire. And while he was out of the bus, I'd jump into the driver's seat and I'd just drive myself to the Drones Club. And the driver would be running along behind the bus, screaming and shouting. And I'd park outside the Ritz and I'd run into the Ritz because I knew that the bus driver wouldn't be able to follow me in there." And I was like, "Right, okay." And he said, and he looked at me and he said, "You know, if you did that today, you would be shot. You would be shot." And it really summed up, you know, it's a lovely anecdote, obviously, but it's just how very incredibly sort of, in a way, unaccountable you were, how anonymous you were. There was, God, I mean, you know, there was absolutely no, it was barely even, I mean, a check, you know, you could just write a check and just sign it and get,
because did they
walk
have
out of the hotel you'd been
trust,
staying
trust
in.
Funds? I mean, did they need to work, or was this a generation that just lived
my
off?
Father didn't.
Yeah.
My father did not. No.
So
no,
he had
no.
to earn his living.
I think his father, yeah. So he had to earn his living because Christopher was, you know, a younger son. And so I think Christopher was, his father was provided for by the sort of Sledmere estate to a certain extent. I mean, I think he would have considered himself dreadfully poor. And we would have thought that probably having a house on Eaton Terrace would mean you're doing all right.
Wow, what a world.
But my father certainly wouldn't have. My father certainly had to make his own money. And yeah, so he ran gambling clubs for a lot of time. Then he got mixed up in various criminal enterprises. He never actually, just to defend my father for a moment, he never actually spent time in prison other than on remand. So he was remanded in custody, and he was deported. He was deported to Australia. But he beat the case in Australia and was acquitted and returned home with his reputation and record intact. So
good. I apologise for that. I think that was in the Times, so I misread it.
No, it's true. He spent time in prison, but he was on remand.
Gosh.
Yeah.
Gosh.
Yeah.
I think we have to wrap this up, Andrew.
But you know, it was a big. There's actually a lovely. And Christopher, you know, his father, obviously, like any father, adored his son. And there's a lovely bit in a letter from, I think, from Nancy Mitford, who was a friend of Christopher's and wrote Noblesse. He contributed to the Noblesse Oblige volume because it was originally that pamphlet was published as a larger volume. And Christopher wrote one of the essays. And there's a lovely letter where Nancy, I think, writes to Evelyn Waugh and says something like, I saw Christopher at the club in London and he was terribly sad and I couldn't get much out of him. But of course, it's something to do with that son who he so adores, you know, and you're just like, yeah, you know. So I think it was, you know, I'm probably inclined to give my dad the benefit of the mitigating circumstances. I think it was a strange time in British society, and I think that I think that the whole world was readjusting after the Second World War. I really do. I think the whole world was, and then of course, you know, in the 60s, and it washed it all away, really. So,
gosh,
we all need to start flagging down buses and telling the driver, to see how far we go. My sympathies with the bus driver. Thank you so much, Tom, for sharing this amazing, very different take on scandalous but fun time.
Great, thanks so much. We've covered a lot of ground.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Scandalmongers podcast. This has been a Podcast World production. You can get in contact with our show by emailing team@podcastworld.org, placing Scandalmongers in the heading, or via our social media links within the show's bio.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.